In this Wanderlust Friday Forum, recorded on February 14, 2020, at the Bozeman Public Library, Dale Martin spoke about mining in Montana and the West. He is introduced by C.D. Happel.
I'm C.D. Happel on behalf of the Friday Forum Committee. Welcome to Friday Forum, and happy Valentine's Day. We are very delighted to have with us Dale Martin. He's talking today in connection with the Bozeman Public Library Foundation's program, One Book, One Bozeman. Friday Forum is delighted to have Dale here for the first time, to have him dig into mining in Montana and the West. Dale grew up in the Seattle area. One branch of his family lived and worked in the silver-rich San Juan Mountains of Colorado. One great-great-aunt ran a boarding house in the mining town of Rico in southwestern Colorado. He lived for 4 years amidst the mines and great steel headframes of Butte, and he has taught courses at MSU on the history of Montana, the First World War, 20th century Middle East, and technology. He's also the author of this book, Ties, Rails, and Telegraph Wires. Dale is a historian and also a train buff. And this is a really wonderful book published in 2018 by the Montana Historical Society Press. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dale.
The schedule for today is I'm going to start off with an introduction to mining, miners, and mining communities, and then go to three examples here in Montana. But first I want to ask you, are there any miners, former miners in this audience? Two, how many of you have lived or were raised or lived for some time in a mining community? About 10, 15, something like that. And then a final question, the reason for this question that will become apparent, how many of you either own an electric car, a hybrid electric car, or would like to have a hybrid electric car?
Tesla.
So, okay, it looks like about half there. So that'll become apparent. I want to say, mining is of the various industrial occupations, I think mining occupies a special place. I grew up in timber country. There's not a lot of glamour about cutting down trees and sawing them up with a 2x4s. But there is a glamour about mining, fully aware of its underside. So I want to start by reading a passage from a novel that came out over a half century ago called How Green Was My Valley, set in a coal mining community in South Wales. Two things to know about Wales. Of course, in the United Kingdom. One is that South Wales coal, anthracite coal, was some of the best steam coal in the world at that time. If you were a steamship engineer, you wanted Cardiff coal, or coal that had been shipped out of Cardiff in South Wales. The other thing is that one of the great traditions of Wales is choral singing, singing in harmony, mass groups of singers. Singing from memory and harmonizing with intuitively or through a background. The setting is in this valley. The narrator's father is one of the leaders of the miners, and Davy is the narrator's brother. A strike has just ended. The miners are returning to work. It was early morning and cold, and the moon had not yet gone down. White frost was hard and thick on the roadway and roofs, and all the lit windows threw orange patches all the way down the street. As the doors opened and the men came out, their wives and children followed them into the road and stood to watch them go. My father was one of the first with Davy, and as soon as the men saw him, they started to cheer, for they all thought he was the savior of the village. But my father was not a vain man, and he disliked any show about him. So he waved them all quiet and started to sing. As soon as they heard his voice, the tenors and altos waited their turn, and then the baritones and basses, and then the women and children. As soon as the singing started, all the doors opened all the way down the hill to the mine, and men and women and children came out to fill the road. I looked at the smooth blue sky and the glowing white roofs, the black road choked with blacker figures of waving men passing down the hill between groups of women and children, clustered around their skirts, all of them flushed by flickering orange lamplight flooding out from open doorways, and heard their rich voices rising in many harmonies, borne upward upon the mists which flew from their singing mouths, veiling cold-pinched faces, magnifying the brilliance of hoping eyes, and my heart went tight inside me. And round us the valley echoed with the hymn, and lights came out in the farms and the dark mountains, and down along at the pit, where the men were waving their lamps, hundreds of tiny sparks keeping time to the beat of the music. Everybody was singing. Peace there was again, see. Many of you have been exposed to mining. Maybe you visited as a tourist, you visited historic mining camps, but one of the ways you've been exposed to it is through literature, both high literature and popular literature, film and television. And the portrayals may be sentimental, as the piece I did, maybe realistic, but also with a sentimental edge, as the piece I just read. They may emphasize the danger of working underground. But you've probably all seen or read of mining portrayed. There was a series of books published in the 1970s by Winston Graham about a landowner in Cornwall, southwestern England, Poldark. And I think at least twice a TV series has been taken from that. The landowner owns a copper mine on his land. And so there's scenes of copper mining 200 years ago in Cornwall. How Green Might Was My Valley by Richard Llewellyn became a movie. And in Appalachia, where there's coal mining, there the main legacy is song. Singers like Gene Ritchie and Loretta Lynn, Merle Travis, you probably know, even if you don't know the whole song, you know the line from Merle Travis, 16 tons, Lord, don't take me now, I owe my soul to the company store. Even Dwight Yoakam, the country musician, wrote a song about reading, writing, and Route 23 in the coal mines of eastern Kentucky. In the Metallic West, Mark Twain, probably one of the best known books about mining, has Roughing It, about silver mines down by Carson City, Colorado. Bret Hart used to be widely read for his popular literature about the California gold rush, but not read much now. It even shows up in places one might not expect. References to mining, the end of mining, the aftermath of mining. One of the better known detective novel series is by a Scotsman named Ian Rankin. His hero is John Rebus. And both he, Rankin the writer, and his hero are from Fife, the county that's just north of Edinburgh. And it was a coal mining community into the mid-20th century. And in one of these novels, the main character, perhaps reflecting the views of the author, Ian Rankin, reflects about what happens after, or as the coal mining fades and disappears. Growing up in Fife, Rebus had seen the same thing with coal. No one planned for the day it would run out. When it did, hope ran out with it. Nobody ever seemed to learn. With that introduction, I want to just talk about some things that I think are not necessarily unique to mining, but I think in combination, these seven factors do make it a unique economic operation and a way of life for the people that did the mining, for the people that lived in those mining communities, and even beyond. And mining can refer to, it basically means digging into the earth to get things from the earth, minerals. And those can be metal, a whole range of metals, of course. It can be coal and fuel. There's peat mining in places like Ireland and Scotland. And there's what you'd call the industrial minerals. Things like china clay that is used to make porcelain, or phosphate rock and potash, which is used for fertilizer, or here in Montana, talc, the mines down by Ennis with the processing plants at Sappington and Three Forks. Those are mining as well. They don't have the glamour of gold or copper, but they still have economic. Mining also, in the general sense, refers not just to extracting that metal or the materials, but the processing, whatever processing is required to turn it into a finished product or a component for a finished product, as well as shipping and transportation as well. So first, mining is essential to the way of life we live. It has been essential as a part of civilized people living in cities, living with industry, living with organized agriculture for thousands of years, perhaps going back 7,000-8,000 years to the first use of copper. It's necessary for us to sustain the way of life we take for granted, and it's going to be necessary, it already is and will, for the billions of people who in the poorer parts of the world who aspire to live the way we do. Whether that's our appliances, our automobiles, communications, and more. There is a tremendous demand for the products of mining. Many of the products of mining are not able to be recycled. Coal obviously gets burned. China clay gets turned to porcelain. You can't grind up porcelain and turn it back. With metals, some of those can be recycled and indeed are recycled. But there are certain uses of metals that require newly mined metals for in terms of purity. When you have recycled metal, impurities get into that metal. You can use the brass for a curtain rod, but not for conducting electricity in a copper wire. Mining involves things that are the ultimate non-renewable resource. That's a bottle of copper on your left hand. Every atom of copper in that bottle was made inside an exploding star, a nova or supernova. So once that copper is used, it can be recycled, but if it's lost, the Earth is not creating these new metals. There is copper being created now in a supernova 100 light years away from us, but it's not going to benefit us. So it is the ultimate recycled, non-renewable, which means recycling, conservation, reducing use is essentially important for the use of metal and mining and the impact of lessening the impact of mining. Mining, because it involves taking things from the earth, whether that's from in the most earliest stages, scraping the side of a hill, people's taking chippable stone, obsidian for probably hundreds of thousands of years, to some of the deepest mines in the world, 13,000 feet deep in South Africa. Mining is disruptive to the earth, to the surface of the earth, to the under parts of the earth, below the surface, to water, and if you could include the processing, the smelting of metals, to the air as well. And so that is an inevitable consequence of extracting metals, materials, minerals from the earth. Is a certain amount of damage is necessary, which is true of most of the products we require, whether they're organic or non-organic, consumable, literally consumable food or not. But sometimes mining, in terms of the scale of the disruption, catches attention more. Until sometime in the 20th century, almost all mining historically was unregulated. So the operators of mines could try to cut costs in terms of whether that was poorly paid work, unsafe working conditions, how they disposed of byproducts of mining and smelting, how they used heat to separate and the kinds of fumes and smokes that might be released and not captured. One of the aspects of mining is that not everything that is dug up is used or usable. There is going to be waste products of mining. And for an open pit mine, it may be that overburden. If whether you're going down for copper or coal, there may be 100 feet of non-economic soil and rock above that has to be lifted up basically and set aside to get into that deposit below. If it's an underground mining with shafts and tunnels, it means you actually have to go through what's called country rock. And that's not a music genre. That's it's rock that miners have to go through that has no economic value. You have to go through, say, granite, for instance, to get to the deposit. And that granite is dumped outside the mouth of the mine. It's waste rock. And so there's, depending on what one is mining for, there's a sometimes little to a lot of waste that is not used. If you have one of those coal seams in eastern Montana or northeastern Wyoming, some of them are up to 80 feet thick, especially in Wyoming. That is 100% of that coal seam is put into trucks, carried to a loading bin, and put in trains for a power plant. So 100% utilization, that's once you've got the overburden taken off. But with metal mining, metals are in ore, which includes non-metallic things, largely quartz, silicon dioxide. And that will eventually have to be separated from the metal and cast aside through concentrating, milling, or through smelting, or even in some cases, refining. And so if you have iron ore, iron is a fairly large portion of the ore. There's a rich iron ore mine in far northeastern and far northern Sweden called Kiruna. And there, the iron comprises 49% of the ore. So half the ore is economic and is put on ships in Narvik, Norway, and the other half is waste. Copper, there's a copper mine, you know, the copper mine in Butte run by Montana Resources. The copper there is 0.25% of the ore, about 5 pounds out of 2,000 pounds of ore. So for every 5 pounds of copper come out of the East Continental Pit, there are 1,995 pounds of waste. Most of that is left in Butte. Some of it will be actually included in concentrates that goes to smelters, mostly in East Asia, and will become slag at those smelters. You also know the gold mine when you're heading west on I-90 past Whitehall. There's that huge gold mine on the hillside south of the highway. The Golden Sunlight mine is owned by a Canadian company called Barrick Gold. That proportion of gold within the ore is measured in parts per million. It's measured in grams per metric ton. And so as of a report 10 years ago, some of this is probably class proprietary information, but 10 to 15 years ago, they were getting 4 grams of gold for every metric ton, 4 parts per million. So that means that everything that comes out of that mine is 99.999-something waste. Much of it, of course, gets left on the right side of the freeway as you head west. But that is one aspect, especially of metal mining, is there's going to be far more waste produced or brought out of the earth than there is product that will end up either at a manufacturing plant or in consumer goods. And then finally, I think mining is like lots of other activities and subjects, is that mining is often, especially by conservationists and environmentalists, mining is judged and assessed by the behavior of irresponsible parties. One could say that there are a variety of groups that, for the critics, they look at a small proportion badly behaving and say the whole group is like, and whether those are proponents of the Second Amendment, whether they're hunters, whether they're environmental activists, people who don't like any of those groups will point at that fringe over there and say, these represent the whole group. And so for one of the mining projects I'll talk about is facing that. Here, an example is, I assume many of you read in the past couple of years, year or two, in Brazil, there's a huge mining company called Vale, spelled V-A-L-E, and they have huge iron ore mining. Brazil has tremendous resources of iron ore. They mine iron ore, the milling of that creates tailings, which is sand-like granules of the waste material. They're put behind dams, earth-filled dams, and then these tailings with water are dumped behind the dams. 2 times in the last couple of years, these tailings dams have failed, and hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of waste tailings have swept down. Well, the first one killed something like 240 people who lived in the towns downhill. Vale had been told by inspectors before these that their dams had issues. German inspectors came in and said, you need to attend to these dams. They're weak. They're vulnerable. The leadership of Vale ignored that. And last thing I heard, I think the president of Vale was either under some sort of retention by the Brazilian government. But the behavior of Vale with these tailings dams and their neglect is in some ways can be, but shouldn't be reflected on other parts of the mining industry. So mining stands out, one, because at least in underground, people go underground. Miners go underground, and that's something that very few of us do, whether we're miners or even cavers. It's a spooky place to be, and especially if you're down hundreds or even thousands of feet, and it's going to take you minutes to get out. And so that gives mining a whole aspect that most other professions don't have. I think seafaring in the age of sail might have been as hazardous. Taking ships around Cape Horn might have matched it, and certainly serving in the military. One thing mining has that almost very few other professions, if you're a homestead, we're a homesteader in Montana, you're not gonna get rich off of it. But if you're a miner, if you're a prospector, and you are panning for gold, you could overnight become wealthy. You could find a rich placer bar, say in Confederate Gulch, by Canyon Ferry Lake, and you could either, by mining it yourself or selling it, some of the first millionaires in Montana made money by finding and developing rich mines and then selling them to consortiums of European investors. The Lexington mine, silver mine at the top of Butte Hill, and the Drumlummon gold mine outside of Marysville near Helena. And $1 million in 1881 was a lot of money, about probably $20 million at least in current money. The other thing about mining is it's not a renewable resource. There's a limit. However big the deposit is, it's going to run out at some point. Some mines have maybe just a year or two. They have a rich deposit, but very small, very shallow. But on the other hand, some can last a long time. In 1988, the Rommelsburg mine in the Harz Mountains of Germany shut down. It had been operating for a millennium. Probably one of the most famous mines in the Americas is in Potosí, where it's a mining district in what's present-day Bolivia. That operated for 500 years and produced over 1 billion ounces of silver at tremendous human cost. That's one thing if you're a miner. You could have a job in a place for the rest of your working life, or in 2 years, you could be picking up your stuff and looking for another job somewhere else. Miners, just a couple of numbers. In 1920, in the 1920 census, 1 out of every 100 Americans was a miner, 1%. There were 105 million people in the U.S. census then, and there were 1 million miners. In Montana, the proportion is probably closer to between 2 and 3%. And of course, in Montana, the great bulk of them were copper miners in Butte. There were 8,500 copper miners in Butte and about 3,700 coal miners, places like Red Lodge, southeast of Great Falls, Stockett, and Sand Coulee. In Britain, during the First World War, the proportion was probably 2 to 3% of the population in mining areas like South Wales, the Midlands of England, and parts of Scotland as well. Miners. The image of a miner, I think for many of us, is a man. It was a masculine operation. Of the 1 million miners in the United States in 1920, there were 3,000 women. So less than 1% of them. So the image of a miner, the historic image, is the man wearing a steel helmet with a lamp or light in front. In the very early times, it'd actually be a candle. And then it'd be a carbide, a gas light. And then ultimately, it would be an electric light with a battery pack on the belt. And in some, that is the image of an underground miner, whether it's coal or metal or potash underneath the Saskatchewan prairies. It is this emblem for the one high school in Montana. Centerville High School is southeast of Great Falls. It's a consolidated high school that draws students from several former coal mining communities, Stockett, Tracy, and Sand Coulee, southeast of Great Falls. And so they are the miners, the Centerville miners. And that is their emblem. And they have another emblem that shows the helmet and an axe, and with the lettering, Miner Pride. There hasn't been mining in that area for many decades, And in many of the signs, the structures are all gone, but that it lives on with that image of a miner. I want to read a couple quotes from The Economist magazine. Their Badgett is their column, is the pseudonym for the column on British politics. And several years ago, he visited one of the last underground coal mines in England, Hatfield, up near York in southern Yorkshire. And this is just a few excerpts. And he's writing, "At their peak, shortly before the First World War, the deep mines of Yorkshire, Durham, South Wales, and other sedimentary places, engines of the Industrial Revolution, employed over 1 million men and boys. They were the foundation of modern British economy, a column that George Orwell, what he wrote, upon whose shoulders nearly everything that is not grimy is supported. Their tight village town culture based on shared endeavor, village cricket, and the miner social clubs were the central to those communities." And then he concludes, because this pit, this colliery, this pit that he's visiting is about to shut down. And he writes, "Badgett had expected to pity them, the miners, in their almost dead trade, and he does. He also feels awe." So the miners lived in mining communities. Mining obviously took place where the deposits were. If you have a coal deposit, a gold deposit, in the era when people walked to work, which is most of human existence, people lived close to their work. And so mining communities were located in places that most people would never choose to live. High in the mountains at a place called Climax, Colorado, where they mined molybdenum, or they used to. I think it's at about 11 or 12,000 feet elevation. Potosí in Bolivia is about 13,000 feet. Sometimes it's in the middle of a hot, dry desert. There used to be many mines in southwest, along the western edge of Nevada, or in other desert settings, or in the middle of a dense forest, maybe harsh and cold. But because that's where the resource was, and that's where the extraction had to take place, that's where the mining communities grew up. And so they relied almost totally on mining, on supporting the miners and housing the miners, and then with the businesses that would feed them, entertain them, clothe them, and the institutions that where the children would go to school, where the families would go to church or worship. Initially, many mining camps were largely full of single men. They were often housed in bunk houses. Sometimes, when the mining was really busy, there would be what they called hut bunking in the bunk houses. Mm-hmm. And that was where you had a bed in a boarding house, and three men slept in that bed, and you got the bed after shift. And then 8 hours later, someone else was going to come in off their shift, or maybe it was a 12-hour shift, and you had to be up and out of there. And so that's the way many mining camps started, and some shorter-lived ones never got beyond that. But eventually, if there was a rich prospect that looked like it was good for decades of operation, that families would come in, you'd have a more conventional city of houses, apartment houses, single family houses, a business district, schools, churches, parish schools, and bars. And actually bars in many mining towns, bars, especially if there were a lot of immigrants, bars were not just a place to drink, they had a free lunch, really salty food, so that you'd go back and get another beer. The barkeeps or the operators would often serve as social centers. They would handle money if someone was sending money back home to Central Europe, or they would handle correspondence. So they became important to as part of the life. You can imagine what Prohibition, which came to Montana at the very end of 1916, did to operations like that. One of the features of certain kinds of mining communities, those that had vertical shafts reaching deep underground, were the great steel headframes. These were great steel headframes with a huge pulley wheel, or actually several pulley wheels, 100 feet or higher. Their main purpose was basically to hold those pulley wheels directly above the vertical shaft. They'd raise and lower the miners, they would lower supplies, they'd raise the ore that had been mined and brought to the shaft. And so Butte, for instance, if you stand on the east edge of the College of Mines, the Montana Tech, and look east or northeast, you will see up to 9 or 10 of these head frames on the hillside. They're now owned by the government of Butte Silver Bow and were purchased to prevent them from being scrapped.
You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman. Dale Martin continues with his Wanderlust Friday Forum lecture, Mining in Montana and the West.
What happens to a town after the mining ends? Either the resource runs out, or at least the rich deposits run out, or perhaps technology changes and that material isn't needed as much, or that if it's a deep mine, the cost of extraction is rising, and some mine in southern Africa that's just beginning can get that same product for a half the price. But eventually, in almost every mining town, it has happened or will happen. The mine operations end, along perhaps with the concentrating mills, the transport facilities, and more. And again, these places are often located in locations, at elevations or in climates that most people aren't going to stick around for once the mining is ended. It was a place to live and earn money, but once that is done, they often leave. And this can be catastrophic for the town. Obviously, the loss of employment, the losses to retail businesses with the disappearance of many residents, and often in many of these towns, the mining company is by far the principal property taxpayer. They pay hundreds of thousands of dollars and support the schools and more. The loss of that corporate taxpayer property can be crippling for a town. And so there are hundreds, probably, if you go beyond North America, thousands of abandoned, and in some cases vanished, mining towns, especially if they were made of wood, short term, with almost nothing left to see unless you would get out on the ground and walk around. But a small number of mining towns in North America were lucky. And after they faded, not necessarily right away, there may have been several decades of inactivity, but it turns out they had slopes above them with lots of snow. And they turned into some of the poshest ski areas now in the United States are former mining towns. Aspen, Colorado, a silver town. Crested Butte, Colorado, which was a coal mining. It was the only source of anthracite coal, the purest form of coal in the western United States. It was mostly used for steel making. Park City, Utah, and one that hasn't flourished quite as much, but it has some of the resort and some skiing, is Red Lodge, Montana, a coal mining town. There are towns that have wanted to emulate that. Kellogg, Idaho, in the Coeur d'Alene Silver Valley, tried really hard to attract skiers. They actually got a federal grant to build a gondola ride up to the top of the hill, but they don't have, the scenery isn't quite as exciting as the Colorado Rockies, and I don't know anything about skiing, but perhaps the skiing isn't as good either. Butte is still working hard to become a heritage, a site for visiting. I guess it depends who you ask how that's working, but they're certainly trying that. That's the background of getting into the three examples. Are there any questions at this point? Yes.
Since your initial question was about electric cars and how much interest there was here, I think the discussion would be apt for a naysayer. Now, some are saying that driving, sitting on such a huge battery daily is not good for the health, and it's a disruption of the body electric and has no help, much like breathing fumes. Now, do you have any qualms about electricity technology?
I will be talking about electric cars in the final example. I'm actually not going to address health issues. I'm going to address more the procurement of the resources. So I'm never going to have an electric car. So selfishly, I'm not worried about it. And I actually don't know. I mean, this has been around for decades with power lines, the magnetic field that power lines create.
Could you talk a little bit about the residual mining issues that are in Montana, that mining companies have gone bankrupt and left the state holding the bag for all the seepage that comes out of these abandoned mines? I understand it's rather severe.
Yes and no. Throughout the Rocky Mountain states and Canadian provinces, there are literally thousands of mines. And some everything from a mine that employed, like in Butte, 17,000 miners at one point, to a small operation that's one or two people. And the main thing is water that runs out of those mines. A lot of the ores are sulfides. They're metals combined with sulfur. And there's often a lot of arsenic in the ore as well. I'm going to address a couple of examples, but that larger issue, I'm not going to come to it.
In this country, you know, there's certainly a way we're going away from coal. But India, China, I'm just trying to get my hands around percentage of the total coal that's produced every year, how much of it goes into those countries that are vast consumers, are huge consumers of it now, and do you see them changing in the youngest of us, our lifetime?
I don't know quantities. I know that about coal in India and China, both have a lot of their own coal. That's why both of them were among the last nations in the world to have steam locomotives in daily railway operation into the 1980s. A lot of the Chinese coal is of poor quality. It burns very dirty. And actually, if the next time you see you're up in the north side of Bozeman and you're stopped on Ras Avenue waiting, and there's a westbound coal train going by, and you can tell because you can see the open hoppers are not covered, and you can see the small ridge, or just the part of the coal ridge that rises above, that may be going to China. Most of it's probably steam coal to generate electricity. It's going to ports in the Puget Sound area. Montana, the state of Montana is pushing for an export port down by Longview, Washington, which the state of Washington does not want. But how long is this going to go on? Well, you know, if you ask the people, not just the government leaders of China and India, they will tell the Western world, the Atlantic, North America, you guys polluted without restraint for 200 years and achieved a very high standard of living, and now you're telling us we have to cut back on our power and do it green before we actually achieve the standard of living you have. You can imagine how well that goes over in international climate. So I think I have no idea what government leaders, what Narendra Modi or Xi Jinping think about global climate change, but I think they want to bring prosperity, electric power to rural villages, to schools, and if it takes burning coal, then they're going to do it. And if it takes burning dirty coal, indigenous coal, then they're going to do it. And so that's my impression.
One follow-up to that. U.S. versus Australia, in the amounts they export.
Australia likes to say that, you know, they make their money off the sheep's back, wool. But actually, they make their money exporting iron ore and coal to industrial East Asia. And you probably read about this, that Scott Morrison, the liberal, i.e. conservative leader of Australia, at one point in the Australian Parliament in Canberra, held up a lump of coal and said, there's nothing wrong with this. And I think the fires in Australia maybe have shifted opinions a bit on global issues and burning coal. But Australia, especially Queensland in the northeast, is heavily dependent on exporting coal, both metallurgical coal and steam coal. And it's going to, you know, there again, there's tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who depend upon that for their living, mining it, transporting it, loading ships in the seaports, and more.
You touched on two things that the cost-benefit analysis of mining. How many people are now, in terms of percentages of populations that are now employed nationally or internationally, and how much is mining now? You know, you talked about mine in Potosi. There was the one in Sweden that's got, you know, 49% value. And I'm wondering now, these days, what percentages are present in various mining operations of value? And so all of it, it's kind of a big question with smaller parts that you can fit whatever you want.
So it's taking, as with many industries, it's taking fewer and fewer people to extract more and more ore. So one of the big changes was going from underground mines to vertical shafts with tunnels, or going into a hillside with an adit and tunnels. that was a very labor, and it remains a very labor-intensive way to mine. The more labor-effective is dig a great big open pit, dig everything up, grind it up, and put it through this concentrating process, and you can employ a fraction. So Butte at its height probably had, depending on what numbers, over 10,000 miners working underground. This would be during the First World War, before the labor troubles got really bad. Right now, Montana Resources, with their open pit, they're taking out 50,000 tons of copper, and they employ about 320 people. And one of the things with a open pit mining is you don't have one or two men in one or two groups with air compressor drills drilling one at a time the holes in the rock that you're going to put the explosives in. Instead, you have a person, probably a man or a woman now, sitting in a vehicle that has drills and that drill into the floor of the open pit. And then, of course, they put explosives and just blow up the whole floor. So people who work in open pit mines, coal, gold, copper, zinc, various metals, China clay and Cornwall, they actually are not, well, they would say they're miners. They are truck drivers, they are shovel operators, they're driving these drill rigs, they're planting explosives, and such sort of thing. So there's fewer people employed. One of the things with mining is when you start mining, generally you start out with the richest, especially metals, richest resources, and you mine them first. And then you mine, say, with copper. You mine the stuff that's 5% copper. Well, then if copper prices are good, there's some 3% copper. You can still mine that and make money. Then there's some 1% copper. Well, copper's at $2.78 a pound right now. You can't mine it. Maybe if copper goes back up to $4.50. So there's just all these variables and markets. It's not a surprise that the mines that operate in the United States have constraints on them that say there's huge copper gold mines in New Guinea, in the Indonesian part of New Guinea, operated by a U.S. company, McMoran. You might guess that they have fewer restraints on labor, on environmental, on the treatment, the way the neighboring indigenous people are affected. And so they can mine copper at a lot lower rate than an operation in Utah or Montana. So it's just such a combination of factors. But generally, fewer people, larger productions, and often requiring more excavation to get the same amount of gold or copper, because you're just decreasing tenor of ore.
And so when you think of costs and benefits, the environmental costs seem to be growing, don't they?
Well, and that's good. I'm going to talk about environmental with the final chapter. And if there's questions still remaining, we can do that. So one thing about mining, and especially coal, I would say, not people of your age, but I would say if this was a classroom at MSU with conventional age college students, most of them have probably never seen a piece of coal. And so, but can you imagine being now if you're a coal miner outside of Gillette, and you could tell people, well, I dig the coal that makes the electricity that keeps these lights on. But there was a time when in millions of households and schools and churches and business offices and other public buildings, people handled coal. People had fireplaces and they burned coal. I remember walking through a city in England one time, this was in the 1970s, and at 4 o'clock you started to smell the coals. Fires were being started up in hundreds of houses and the smell of coal smoke, which to me was exotic at the time. It made me think of how green was my valley. And being a coal miner, when you knew that your product was going to be used every day and handled every day in millions of houses and small offices and schools, that I think gave a sense of participation in the economy, in people's daily lives, that many miners don't have anymore. In so many ways, it's not just from mining, it's from logging and lumbering, and we're so detached from the processes that bring us electricity, water, paper, and more. So, three examples of mining and aspects of policy, environment, labor, and more. I want to start off with one that I assume almost all of you know about, you've read about, and that is W.R. Grace outside of Libby, Montana. Vermiculite is a product that was developed, it was known about in the 1800s, but in the early 1900s, its usefulness became apparent. Vermiculite is a rock. It's a complicated compound. It's like mica. It has many layers. And in between those layers are water, this part of being in the ground. If you break up vermiculite into small particles and then you heat it, that water turns to steam and it pops the vermiculite and it becomes larger. And then you can make it, use it, it's fireproof, it does not burn. You can use vermiculite for insulation. There's air sealed in the vermiculite and there's air sealed, mostly sealed between the fragments of vermiculite. And it was the wonder material. It was useful because it was relatively cheap. It was available in huge quantities in places like outside of Libby. It was fireproof, so it served double purposes that way. And it was heavily promoted, especially for insulation. Probably some of you read that the World Trade Center towers that were destroyed in September 2001 had Libby vermiculite in them. But it can also be, if you have really clayey soil, you can put it into that soil, break up the soil, and more. So in the 1920s, a huge deposit was discovered in a mountaintop several miles east of Libby. Initially, it was mined by a company called Zonalite, and that was the trade name of their product. That company was bought in 1963 by W.R. Grace, a huge industrial company based back east, and they mined vermiculite there until 1990. The actual process involved extracting it, open pit mining, and then putting it in a mill where it was cleaned, separated, and made into particle size. The expansion would not occur in Montana. You're not going to fill a boxcar that's mostly air. So the unexpanded would be put into bags and boxcars, shipped to expansion plants around the United States, where it would be expanded and then distributed locally. There was the mining area. There was the milling operation, which is very, very dusty inside. In 1956, the state health department sent an inspector to the mine and particularly to the mill where the crushing operation went. That inspector determined the vermiculite product was actually 8 to 21% asbestos, tremulite asbestos. And if you've ever seen a microscope, they're needles. They just look vicious, you know, expanded 100 or 1,000 times. And so the state health inspector, this is still a Zonalite company, determined that, gave the report to the management. They never told the workers. And when W.R. Grace bought that company operation in 1963, they presumably got all the files. They learned that someone saw that health report. They never told the workers. They actually took x-rays. They had x-rays taken of the workers. And if a worker who worked in the mill had really bad x-ray results, they'd be moved to a cleaner place without explanation, without explanation. So for 27 years under W.R. Grace operation, 1963 to 1990, those workers, especially in the mill, but also in the expansion plants, were being poisoned. And the company did not tell them. The mine shut down for a variety of reasons in 1990. 10 years later, by 1999, many Libby residents were having a horrible time breathing, and some had even died from respiratory problems. A pulmonologist in Spokane, many of them ended up going to a pulmonologist in Spokane. And in 1999, two reporters from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, one of whom is now the editor of the Montana Standard, David McCumber, broke the story that the workers were working in asbestos and the company had never told them. And so if you were in Montana at that time, it was in the news a lot, and especially because through the 1990s, our governor had grown up in Libby, Mark Roscoe, a Republican. And so there were Libby people who said by the turn of the century that they said up to 200 people had died prematurely because of exposure. And it wasn't just the workers. The workers were to come home in their old coveralls coated with white powder. They'd get sand in the porch, the enclosed porch in the front of the house. or maybe even inside the house, take off these overalls, the powder, the ground up vermiculite and asbestos would become part of the house. So it was like secondary smoke from a cigarette. And depending on who you ask, by this time, up to 400 people have died from asbestos. But there are people who live in Libby who don't believe it. They say there was something else. Maybe they were heavy smokers. Maybe they had other respiratory problems. And part of it, I think, from what I've read, is class. A lot of the workers in the mines were recent, a lot of them are recent immigrants to Libby, leaving the Dakotas during a harsh agricultural time. And a lot of the longtime residents apparently did not work in the mine. They worked in the sawmills, most of which are now closed, or they ran small businesses, they taught in the schools. And so there is a lot of dispute to this day about just, is this the worst environmental crime in the United States, 400 people dead, or is that not true? There's still dispute. What many of you may remember is 2009, a federal grand jury indicted several of the executives of the W.R. Grace Company in their headquarters back east, as well as the longtime plant manager. They went to federal trial in 2009. The judge, Donald Malloy, longtime judge in the Missoula federal district court, excused several of those defendants. So three executives from the Grace Company went on trials. Probably, as I remember it now looking back, 10, 11 years, probably one of the most watched trials in recent Montana history. The UM Law School actually ran a blog during that, and it got almost daily coverage. The National Wire Services, it was Love Canal, it was Three Mile Island. It got the same level of attention. And as the trial neared its end, the jury first went into deliberations. And on the day that it was going to be announced, it was probably one of the most stunning verdicts in recent Montana history. The jury acquitted all three W.R. Grace executives. And so here's a quote from Donald Malloy, the judge, and he expressed his perturbance with the prosecution. U.S. Judge Donald Malloy was visibly frustrated at times, at one point telling prosecutors that they presented discombobulated allegations and you don't understand the evidence yourself. Must be pretty depressing to be a prosecuting attorney and hear that from the presiding judge. He has much accused one of the witnesses, former Grace employee, of perjury and told the jury to disregard much of Locke's testimony. So it was a stunning verdict. And the people who believe that they, their families, their community have been poisoned knowingly by W.R. Grace were obviously very upset by it and remain so. And more have died. This is 20 years ago. But there were other people. Here's a man from Libby quoted in the article. Ed Baker, a former city councilman and business owner in Libby, said he knew the company wasn't guilty. Baker said that his father worked at Zonalite, the name of the mill before Grace bought it, and died of asbestos-related diseases in 1983. And here's Baker. They knew this stuff wasn't good for them. They were miners. You take your risks. I knew all the guys that worked there with my dad. They all died of the same thing. So there's an aspect to mining of risk. And whether it's black lung in a coal mine or white lung of silicosis in a coal mine or silicosis in a hard rock mine from the quartz that's pulverized or from asbestos, there's still that aspect of risk and justice or perhaps not. Work still continues. For a long time, it's run by the EPA. The EPA has now turned over direction of cleaning up this to the State Department of Environmental Quality, although the EPA is still involved, but they've given up the leadership. And I think there were 8 zones that they had to work on, mining, milling, transportation, and more. 2 of them have been declared done. So that released 6 or so.
Questions? Does all vermiculite have asbestos in it?
No, vermiculite is still widely mined. The main producers these days are South Africa and Brazil. Libby was a very unusual circumstance, and perhaps why it was allowed to go on, not allowed, why it went on so long. It wasn't a common occurrence.
As an addendum to that story, W.R. Grace will pay for 60% remediation if you prove that you have the vermiculite from the Libby mine. and they'll also pay 60% of the insulation replacement.
Right, so that was about W.R. Grace. Those executives were acquitted, but the company itself continues to spend lots of, you know, spend at least $250 million so far. They're still taking, in terms of the community or individuals, there still are responsibilities. So that's a good point. They're still running a tab on this, both in terms of money and responsibility. So the next one I want to go to is one that is in the news right now, or at least an aspect of that is. And that is, if there was a place that was named for what happened there in Montana, I would say Colstrip, probably. And there's nothing subtle. It was first built by the Northern Pacific Railway for the steam. They could have called it Happy Valley or something like that. But they were, you know, it was probably an engineer, very literally. Let's call it Colstrip. They just took out the A. Just take out the, misspell it so it looks a little different. So Colstrip, of course, is a couple hundred miles east of here. It was developed in 1923, 1924 by the Northern Pacific Railway, the railway that built the line that runs through northern Bozeman right now, what's now Montana Rail Link, and it was to fuel their steam locomotives. They had other mines in Red Lodge and even up on Bozeman Pass, but this was going to be a huge supply, and it was going to be strip mined from the very beginning. The coal seam at Colstrip is 24 feet thick. And the amount of overburden above it ranges from maybe 50 to 100 feet. So starting in 1924 with huge shovels, first to remove the overburden, set it aside, and then shovels to take out the coal, it was mined from Colstrip, and that's what fueled the steam locomotives. The steam engine crews often did not like it. It was a fairly low-grade but sub-bituminous. It didn't burn very well, or at least if you weren't an experienced fireman. Cynically, they called it dirt that burns. But by the late 1950s, the railroad, like most railroads in the U.S., had converted to diesel electric power. They didn't need coal anymore for steam locomotives. The steam locomotives were gone. So the mine went inactive for about a decade. Not much happened there. And then in the late 60s, an arm of the Montana Power Company, Western Energy, acquired the mine and sort of resumed strip mining. Initially, to mine the coal to be put on trains. Some of it would go to the Corette plant in Butte on the southeastern edge of Billings. And then eventually they were selling coal to Midwestern utilities as well. And then in the mid-70s, two big electric generating plants were built there too, so that the coal would literally travel just 5 miles or so from the mine to these Colstrip plants numbers 1 and 2. They were owned partially by Montana Power and by what was then Puget Sound Power and Light, Puget Sound Energy right now. Those are the plants, you probably read about this, that right about New Year's Day were shut down. After 45 years of operation, plants 1 and 2 were shut down. However, plants 3 and 4, which were built in the mid-80s, 10 years after the first two plants, still remain. They're partially owned by Northwestern Energy. You pay your bills to them, as well as several companies that are in Oregon and Washington. Now, in both states, the government, the legislature has decreed that the companies that supply electricity in those states, it has to be sustainable, meaning not from fossil fuels. So those companies are trying to get out. They still are using those plants, but they plan to stop using them. The great big power line that takes that power, you cross it when you're on between Townsend and Tustin, when you're on the highway to Helena. And so the future of the coal mining at Colstrip is in a certain level of doubt. The first two plants that were built there are done. I assume they're in the process of demolition, or at least preparing for demolition. Plants 3 and 4 are operating indefinitely. The coal company, Westmoreland, that works there has just signed a 5-year contract to supply coal for the next 5 years. So that, and I think that the deadline in Oregon and Washington for them to stop using coal is in the 5 to 10 year range. So that's the situation as of now. And what many of you have probably read about is Northwestern Energy, which distributes all our electricity, wants to buy 25% of plant 4, one of the two newer plants, from Puget Sound Energy for $1, and that they would use this. And the issue becomes electric power. How do you generate it, and can you store it? The thing with electric power right now is it has to be used as soon as it's, or literally within seconds of when it's generated. You can't generate a bunch of electricity and put it in a great big storage battery. That they don't exist on the scale of the, that would be necessary to, say, supply the large cities of Montana. So if you're a utility, you can predict a certain amount of the electricity you'll need. You have years of seasonal patterns. You can look back at it, figure out how much was used in a certain month and where. But you can't anticipate that sharp cold snap that might start tomorrow, and or a really, really hot thing in July when all the air conditioners, that everybody that has an air conditioner is going full blast. Then you need a lot more energy quickly. And whenever that surge of demand rises, maybe the wind isn't blowing. Maybe the sun is behind clouds and those solar panels are only operating at 40% efficiency. You need a source of power where you can literally turn a button and all of a sudden a conveyor is putting coal or natural gas into a furnace and boiling water that will spin the generator around. And so that is Northwestern Energy's argument, is we need this plant and we need more control over it so that we can generate nearly on-demand electricity in turn, especially in terms of weather conditions, or in terms of all you with your electric cars deciding to plug them in all at the same time. But you can imagine that there's many people in Montana, individuals and organizations, that want Northwestern Energy to, if anything, reduce its ownership and operation of fossil fuel-based generated electricity. They want them to go with thermal where it's possible, wind power, and more. And so that's what the argument is about now. And I think probably also part of the argument is about the future of Colstrip. They presumably don't want Northwestern Energy stuck 5, 10, 20 years from now with this huge liability of a power plant not necessary and the huge costs of closing it down and more.
You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman. Dale Martin continues with his Wanderlust Friday Forum lecture, Mining in Montana and the West.
Whatever happens in Colstrip, Colstrip has a population, I think about 2,500, something like that. And if the plants 3 and 4 close, or when they close, there's very little. The Colstrip could probably get by with 50 people. So what do 2,300 people do? Some of them could be second, third, maybe even fourth generation in Colstrip. And you've probably seen one of the representatives in the legislature, Duane Ankeny, is a really strong voice for preserving the plants that remain and preserving the town of Colstrip. Because as with mining towns or mining-related towns, once the mining is gone, there's no ski slopes next to Colstrip. There's no great canyons to look at. It's going to be perhaps a ghost town at some point. The final example is about a mine that doesn't exist yet. And I'm sure many of you have read about this, and that is the Black Butte Copper Mine, proposed about 15 miles north of White Sulphur Springs. The operation is primarily owned by an Australian company called Sandfire. They run a huge underground copper mine in Western Australia. And it will be a copper mine. The ground level is something around about a mile high, the elevation there, about 500 feet below the surface of what they want to be a future mine, is a copper deposit that is 4% copper. By today's standards, that is rich. When you compare to Butte with 0.2% copper, and then 1,000 feet below that deposit is another deposit that's 6% copper. And if they get into operation, they'll be among the richest 10 copper mines in the world. And so they are pushing for this. As many of you know, it's next to Sheep Creek, a creek that runs, when it passes the coal mine site for another 16, 18 miles, it runs into the Smith River, probably one of the most beloved floating rivers in Montana, as well as fishing. This is where the behavior of a small group of mining operations around the world, whether that's in Colorado or in Brazil or in Romania, there have been examples of catastrophic, especially when tailing ponds break and spew out millions of cubic feet of tailings. This is where that reputation that some people apply to the whole mining industry is something that Black Butte Copper has to face. And one they point out is that this is not going to be an open pit mine. It will be underground. They'll have access through ramps that spiral down to the deposits. They are in a heavily regulated environment. They're not in Irian Jaya in Indonesia or in the Republic of Congo, which has almost no regulation, well, hardly has a government, much less regulations of mining, and that they're heavily regulated and more. So this gets back to electric cars, but not the health aspect. The United States uses, I won't say consumes, because we don't, we use more copper every year than is turned in by recycling. Either we have to mine more here or import it from overseas, such as, say, from Chile, which is the major producer of copper in the world. And a huge amount of copper is recycled. If it's in large enough pieces, it can be the copper or brass, copper alloys. It can be turned back into curtain rods or, you know, table ornaments and more. But if the main use for, a main use for copper is it's the best conductor, bar one, among all the elements. Silver is the best conductor. It's a very expensive way to make wiring. So copper is the next best. It has very low resistance. It's very efficient in conducting electricity. But to make wire for electricity, whether that is for wiring inside these walls or whether it's for a huge amount of wiring inside a motor or inside a transformer, the thing about copper, especially in wiring, is we never see it. It's hidden from us. It's behind walls in wiring. It's inside a machine, inside an electric car, electric mixer, a microwave. It's inside transformers. And so copper is all around us working, but we don't see it. And to make wire for copper, it's almost required to have newly mined copper. Recycled copper, all sorts of copper is dumped into a huge bin. It's melted down. There's certain levels of purification, everything from the plastic that insulated the wires, and there's other alloys of aluminum and lead and zinc. It's apparently really hard to purify that recycled copper. If you get newly mined copper that goes through the concentration, the smelting, and the refining, you can get copper that has only one part per 10,000. Of impurity, and that is ideal for conveying electricity. The average automobile, internal combustion, has about 50 pounds of copper in it. I think it's been a long time since radiators were made of copper. They're aluminum now, but it's wiring and probably some, you know, there are motors. There's a windshield wiper motor. A hybrid gas electric probably takes about twice that much, about 80 to 100 pounds of copper. An all electric car requires probably 180 pounds, 180, 3 to 3.5 times as much copper as gasoline. And a large part of that is for the motor. You're going to have the stator, the fixed part of the motor, and you have the rotor that moves in the electric field. And there's going to be hundreds of miles of wiring on both of those to create that magnetic electric field, as well as the battery. I don't know where it is, but it requires 72 pounds of copper in it. So electric cars require a lot of copper. It has to be newly mined copper to get that 99.97 or better percentage copper. And now that copper could be either mined in Irian Jaya in Indonesia with very few restraints on the mining operation. It's a massive operation. The mining is taking place at 13,000 feet elevation, and every day tens of thousands of tons of tailing are being dumped down the mountainside, and they're fouling the rivers that flow down into the lowlands. The copper has to come from somewhere. Recycling isn't the thing with copper. Is it's put into long-lasting. It's not like aluminum cans that may be get used, tossed away. Most copper ends up in long-enduring utilities and vehicles. And it's also part of better living. So people throughout Asia and India want not copper per se, but they want the things that copper are in. So this Black Butte copper, it's a domestic source for copper, obviously domestic source. It's going to be heavily regulated. It's gone through a draft environmental impact statement with State Department of Environmental Quality. There were hearings last summer. The final EIS was supposed to be out at the end of 2019, but as far as I know, it's not out yet. what the people at Black Butte Copper would say is the United States needs the copper. It's better to get it in a highly regulated environment in the United States than, say, from overseas, and that this is a very rich source. So that would be what they say. It would also, for at least probably 10 years, rejuvenate the economy of White Sulphur Springs. The job, it would probably employ several hundred people, paying $70,000 or more a year. So if you've heard about it, if you've read about it, that's the copper side. The other side is the people who use the rivers, whether it's floating or fishing or some combination, and who can say, well, what about Summitville, Colorado? What about that gold mine in Romania? So,
as I understand it, there are not a lot of smelters left here in America for copper. In fact, I think the answer is it's zero.
Three?
Okay. But what I understand from that mine is they're going to be exporting the refined stuff to some place in some far-off land to be smelted, to be re-imported back here. So I think that this, you've got to look at that in light of your argument of domestic copper here.
You're right. There are three copper smelters in the United States. There's two in southern Arizona, and there's one just west of Salt Lake City. There's no lead smelters. There's zero lead smelters. To use an existing operation, because that's a good point, is when Montana Resources has a batch of copper concentrates that they were, I assume what they do is they bid it out to all these copper smelters. And if a copper smelter in Japan says, we'll smelt and refine this for so much a ton, you know, I think that's what will happen. The three copper smelters in the U.S. are probably busy just with their associated mines, Bingham Canyon and such. So that is true. And then there's going to be a lot of transportation as well. 10,000 miles of transportation. So, yes, it's complicated. The question was, is there an example of a mine in the United States that is just an exemplar? There's so many aspects, but the oldest open pit copper mine in the world is just southwest of Salt Lake City. It's called Bingham Canyon Mine. They've been digging there for 114 years. And it's now owned by an English company, Rio Tinto Mining Company. And I would say by their measure, they've just invested a whole bunch of money in the smelter that processes that. So I think if you asked Rio Tinto about the Bingham Canyon Mine, they would say, that's it. Now, there's so many ways to assess success, you know, in terms of strictly bookkeeping. I have no idea what its environmental record is. Labor relations, community relations, planning for, you know, since the 1972 Montana Constitution, I don't know if other states have this, every mine, when it opens, it has to put up a bond, assuming that the company goes broke. They have to put up a bond that will pay for reclaiming that mine if the company can't do it. But if they don't go broke, they're responsible for that. So I've known, you know, there's so many factors that would go into your question that I don't feel. Yeah.
There's only three smelters. We've talked about the processing, and they got stamp mills and then the concentrator, and then you say refining. What are the steps, and would this product from this mine or from Butte, are any of those processes done locally? And I think earlier you had mentioned the annual production of the Butte mine, did you?
Yeah. About 50,000 tons of copper of content. You know,
okay.
It's not actually, at least it is concentrates. But
okay.
So you have copper ore. We'll take it from Butte. It's got 4 pounds. Here's a big block of ore that's about that big, weighs a ton, got 4 pounds of copper in it, 1 pound of molybdenum, which is used to make steel stronger. The first step is concentrating. You want to turn something that has 0.25% copper into about 30% copper. And so you grind it up, you put it in thousands of vats of water with chemical reagents in it, and there's all sorts of bubbles on top of these concentrating things. The copper, you know, so you have all this granite and silica and more, and the copper and the metal sticks to the little bubbles, and everything else sinks to the bottom of these tanks. So all you do is you skim off those bubbles with all the little flecks of metal in it, and it still has impurities, but now you have copper concentrates. You've reduced by a huge amount the bulk of it. Now you have a sand. I've never actually seen copper concentrate. I assume it's a very fine, almost flour-like consistency, but it's about 30% copper. That will be put into rail cars in Butte, and it'll probably be shipped to Portland or Tacoma or Seattle, put on ships. And some of it may go to the Asarco smelter in Arizona, which was a part owner for a while. But I suspect much of it goes to either Japan or China. And smelting is where you use heat. You take the concentrates, you melt it with tremendous amounts of heat and energy. You turn it into a molten mass, and by the density of the various materials, the metallic part sinks down lower, the other parts, including iron, because there's iron in there, but its iron is less dense than copper, and the silica and the quartz, all that will become slag, and that gets dumped off. It looks like black rock. You've probably seen the slag pile when you go into Anaconda from the west. They look like huge black sand dunes. That's slag. That's the process of smelting. Now you have nearly pure copper. It's cast into what are called anodes. They're huge sheets of copper, several inches thick, 2 feet by 3 feet, weighs 600 pounds, and it's 98%, 99% copper. It's still got a lot of contaminants in it, especially if you want to conduct electricity. So now it goes to an electrolytic refinery, of big pools of electric water with certain chemicals in it. And then you have electricity coming in one end and a circuit. You put these cast anodes, and then you have starter plates of cathodes. And then you start pumping electricity through this. The atoms of copper, one atom at a time, will leave the smelted anodes, move through this thing, and attach them to the cathodes, which are 99.99% pure copper. Now you can roll it into sheet, you can pull it, make it into wire, you can make it into tubing, or whatever.
Thank you. Thank
you.
You have just heard a Wonderlust Friday Forum lecture given by Dale Martin about mining in Montana and the West. It was recorded on February 14th, 2020 at the Bozeman Public Library. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.